Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the gold room of the Lobot Lounge. Ooh. We've been expecting you. Please have a seat. Put your money away. Your money's no good here, but your credit is very, very good. Because here today in the Lobot Lounge, the gentlemen nerds are gathering to discuss Stephen King, the great science fiction and horror author whose works have been adapted so many times into film and television. We're going to discuss our favorite Stephen Kings, our not-so-favorite Stephen Kings, and of course, the new wave of remakes that are taking over the theaters of Stephen King's works being adapted again and shown again because they're timeless tales. Here gathered in the gold room of the Lobot Lounge is Mickey Finn. And Mark Finn.
I'm going to scare the hell out of you.
Aaron DiOrive.
Meteor shit! That was the line I was looking for.
I am now always going to be accused of stealing Mickey's lines. You know this now, right?
No. It's just a thing. I would have stolen it from you, except for the fact that I couldn't remember the actual phrasing of it.
And who loves you and who do you love? It's me, your emotional touchstone and host, Joseph Fotinos. That was from The Running Man, of course.
Yes.
Nice. Yes. Well, welcome again, gentlemen, and it's always good to see you. Our bartender is bringing our first round, so let's jump into this. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the gentlemen nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are four entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about geeky and nerdy things, mostly in the vein of film, television, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many, many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Stephen King, oh my gosh, quite frankly, you can't really have a discussion on horror, cinema, and or entertainment without Stephen King's name cropping up.
Nope, not possible.
Not possible, because, I mean, he's so influential, and the films that the stories he has written that have produced films that have become so indelible in our popular culture, in the zeitgeist that is our horror culture. Everyone knows that creepy car and the hallway and the twin girls and a rabid Saint Bernard and a woman who could start little girl who could start fire with her brain. You know, it's all here. You can't bury your cat out in that Pet Sematary because, by God, that thing's going to come back and it's going to be not as it was before. Great stuff like that. I don't even know where to begin, frankly. There's so much.
There is. I'll tell you what. I'll begin by letting you know what my first exposure to Stephen King was.
Oh, okay.
Even before I'd read anything of his, and of course I was familiar with him, the first thing I remember very clearly having the Stephen King brand on it, because I didn't see Carrie when it was released in the theater. I was too young. Salem's Lot, the television version of Salem's Lot. And in fact, I remember seeing it and loving it so much and being so creeped out by the floating vampire child at the window that I immediately sought out the book. I had not read any Stephen King up to that point. And so my first Stephen King book that I read was, of course, Salem's Lot, which is brilliant and wonderful. And I believe his early stuff, I will argue throughout this podcast that his early stuff was just so much better than his later stuff. Not that his later stuff is not good, but if you read that early stuff, you know, The Shining, Carrie, Salem's Lot, that's when you get to see, in my opinion, you get to see Stephen King at his absolute best. Mm-hmm. And so that was my experience. My first experience with Stephen King was the Salem's Lot TV show. How about you guys?
Now, well, it's real quick. I want to jump into, you mentioned Carrie and a memory popped into my head of the story. It might be apocryphal. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but that his wife, Tabitha, dug Carrie out of the trash that Stephen King, he didn't think it was good, so he tossed it.
And I've heard that story enough to think that it is true.
And Tabitha pulled it out and sent it in.
Yeah.
And it became Carrie.
Or at least she pulled it out and convinced him to continue working, not to abandon it.
Yeah.
And thank God. Thank you, Tabitha.
Right.
because no, absolutely. But I think that speaks. This is part of why I love his early stuff, and I think his early stuff is best, mm-hmm. because that's when Stephen King was still. When he still didn't know, he was writing from his heart. He was writing stuff that mattered to him, stuff that scared him, mm-hmm. but he wasn't sure. He was like, "Is this crap? Is anyone gonna like this? Is this worth telling?" And it turns out, yes. In fact, it was worth telling. But I love that I don't know if you want to call it humility, but I love that aspect of him that he yeah. wasn't sure. He didn't know. He was just trying his best. And that raw element of storytelling is there in his early works.
Yeah. And that's an element that I really enjoyed, but I didn't really feel that I knew Stephen King at all until I read Dance Macabre, which isn't really a story at all. It's his overview of horror entertainment in general.
Yeah,
but he takes the way he writes it. You know, he takes you on this dance. Come on, the music's starting. Let's talk about this. And he goes all through history. Now, reading that book, I felt like, oh, I know this guy. Because this guy grew up in the same influences that I grew up in, not in the That's same right. era, obviously, but he talked about famous monsters and old horror movies and how things scared him and what scared him and what worked in. And every chapter opened with a different real life newspaper clipping or report of a horrible thing happening being influenced by horror movies.
Yeah, right.
And it's a really wonderfully put together. I've read that book over and over and over again. Again, it's not really an entertainment kind of a fantasy book with characters. It's Stephen King talking to you. It's like spending an evening with Stephen King, which is very nice. So
it is, and it's absolutely worth it. If anybody, if any of you listeners have not read Dance Macabre by Stephen King, I highly recommend it. Not only if you're interested in writing and telling stories, but just interested in him and his storytelling and just storytelling in general.
I'm going to go even further out on a limb and claim that the best stuff that he ever writes is nonfiction.
Oh, okay.
Dance Macabre, On Writing, the articles that he's written online and everything like that. Is my favorite writing from him, bar none.
Interesting.
Okay. I like his voice much better in that than when he's actually telling a story.
I won't go so far out on that limb with you, but I will on coming back off that limb a little bit. I think his best work is his short fiction. I think he is a gifted short story writer.
I agree.
The likes of which we have not seen in a while. And I find that his...
While I'll agree with you on that, I will fight you on that against Harlan Ellison.
Well, I think the problem with Harlan Ellison is that Harlan has believed his own press for the longest time.
Yes.
I will fight both of you on that for Ray Bradbury as being the best short fiction writer, but go ahead.
No.
Ray Bradbury.
But when it comes to King, some of his opinions are a little outdated now, but Dance Macabre is definitely a good place to start. Oh, yeah. I did not start with Dance Macabre. I ended up I started first with Carrie. I was actually the first Stephen King thing I read.
Nice.
And it was about the same time that I was getting into horror writing and reading things. It was before The Shining came out. It was almost at the time when Salem's Lot had been announced or that they were talking about it. And so I wanted to catch up on.
Which, by the way, Toby Hooper directed Salem's
That's
Lot.
Right.
Salem's Lot.
So I read Carrie, and the first thing that struck me about it was that it was structurally very similar to Dracula in that it was an epistolary novel. I thought that was I caught that as a kid and thought, oh, neat, there's more than one way to, you know, I thought Dracula was just going to be this way. No, there's other things like this. So I you know, kudos for that.
Yeah, but, he even talks about that in the foreword, by the way. He talks about Salem's Lot is his love letter to Bram Stoker's Dracula, which he loves. So,
yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, just on Salem's Lot, I remember, because like Aaron, I saw the original TV miniseries that Toby Hooper directed with Reggie Nalder as Kurt Barlow, and it terrified me. And then when I read the book immediately afterwards, I went, oh, he flipped him around. Because in the book, Barlow is suave and handsome and well-spoken and good-looking. And it's Stryker who's bald and pockmarked and hideous. Yeah. So he flipped them around, which I thought was an interesting thing. But visually, I love that horrible Nosferatu-looking vampire that he created for Salem's Lot. Because they did it again. TNT did Salem's Lot as a one-shot, kind of a two-part, I think, on TNT when they had Rutger Hauer playing Kurt Barlow. And it was much more...
He played him a lot more like he was in the novel.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I think TNT became, for me, it was like the... TNT, we're the network that's going to adapt Stephen King stories the way they were written.
Yeah.
Didn't they do The Shining, too?
They did do the horrible Shining. Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Yes, they did.
Mark has a thing.
Shame on you.
I was not a fan.
I was not a fan of the remake of The Shining.
Nor was I.
Which is funny because it was one of these podcasts where we argued that, where somebody said The Shining is the worst Mark said worst adaptation of a Stephen King novel on the basis of it being an adaptation. Was I think it's actually one of the most brilliant adaptations of a Stephen King novel, because I don't think adaptations need to be slavish to the material. But there are people. There are people that will insist that, you know, it's Shining's a good movie, but it's not a Stephen King novel. You know, and that is an argument that can be defended. So. Yeah.
For the longest time, you couldn't have a good Stephen King movie.
Well,
if it was good, it wasn't a Stephen King movie.
I think part of the reason for that is because, at least early on, nobody knew how to adapt the guy.
Right.
And if you look at his early stuff, his early works, what's nice about his earliest writings is it's all very left of center. Those of you that are interested in the writing side of Stephen King need to go find a gentleman named Don Robertson. Don Robertson is one of the secret ingredients in King's writing for his unique turn of phrase and the way that Don would work history into a narrative. And that was something that King was really interested in, and he explores it in his short fiction and in his longer works, especially where the Castle Rock stuff is kind of concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But most earnestly in Derry, Maine for the book It.
Yeah.
All of the backstory stuff was Stephen King doing his best Don Robertson imitation.
Really?
Now, I think, yes. And
just because it's interesting that you say that, because the establishment is important in a Stephen King novel. I just real quick sidebar, I'll get right back to you, Mark, on this, but I really feel it's important. In Dance Macabre, he explains his formula. He calls it the platform and the tilt. And it's very, 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 very spelled out. You establish the norm, normal family, wife, child, mother, dog. Then you tilt the platform. Suddenly the mother's possessed. He eats the dog. The kid goes haywire. Something happens. But it's important to establish the platform before you tilt it. So you're talking about the establishment of like Derry, Maine and the normals. Is that what you were saying?
Exactly. The platform. He bases a lot of his platform writing on Don Robertson. And Robertson was a guy who wrote in a very conversational way. He had a unique way of whenever he would write numbers out, especially dates, he wouldn't hyphenate them. If you were 23, you were 23 without a hyphen. It was very interesting. It was a sort of a weird little stylistic tick. Flag Full of Stars and Miss Margaret Ridpath and the Dismantling of the Universe are chock full of Stephen King stuff, but the book you're going to be able to find and read and enjoy is The Greatest Thing Since Sliced Bread. That is, it's actually a trilogy that Robertson wrote that I can't recommend highly enough. They've all three been reprinted. The sum and total of Now and The Greatest Thing That Almost Happened were the other two. So highly recommended. All of the stuff that takes place in Ohio, in this valley of Paradise Falls, Ohio, this mythic area of Ohio, these characters show up in other things. Morris Byrd is a child in The Greatest Thing Since Sliced Bread. In Flag Full of Stars, he's an adult and he's a politician. But it's Morris Byrd. It's the same guy, you know. And so you can track this stuff and these characters. It's a very was it Edith Wharton that wrote about in the same universe? Anyways, King does it, of course, to an extent with Castle Rock and Derry, Maine.
Yeah,
but and also I think that Black. I think that the early stuff is the best stuff, and it's also the weirdest stuff. So much of Stephen King books take place in the narrative, in the heads of other people. And especially in the 70s and 80s, that was very difficult for folks to translate into a workable screenplay. Mm-hmm. And part of it is because they were trying to shove this screenplay into an accepted mold. We have to take the screenplay and make it look like a horror movie. And I think some of the best Stephen King adaptations are the ones where they let the subject matter dictate what the movie is. I can give you a couple of examples. It's because to me, you can break Stephen King stuff into one category where the Stephen King movies, where the original work is largely maintained. Okay. Mm-hmm. A good example of this, right, just to pull a few off that, would be Christine.
Okay.
That book and that movie line up, you know, in more ways than they don't. Stand By Me, a great example, right, with Rob Reiner. Misery, another terrific version where, you know, we'll let the subject matter dictate what this movie's going to be. The Dark Half, a lesser movie.
Love that
but
movie.
Accurate film. Really.
You mentioned that you're saying about the subject matter. That's I can't think of two films that more embody that way of thinking than The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile.
Yes, his prison movies.
Yeah,
right. I didn't list those because I just thought I'd keep it at five. The Mist was the other one that I had in mind.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So those are they take the material. They say we're gonna adapt this from Stephen King stuff, and we're gonna make this movie and try to get as much King content into the film as possible, because that's what works when we read it. The other side is where they take the movie and said, you know, screw it. We're going to make the movie we want to make based on maybe one or two things in this, but not really. And that's where you get Firestarter. that's where Silver Bullet comes from.
Firestarter Unbound.
That's where Maximum Overdrive comes from.
Well, Maximum Overdrive is Stephen King being Stephen King. Because he directed it too. It was his directorial debut.
Yeah. And proof that there was still really nice uncut cocaine in Hollywood at that time, because that's what that movie's propped up on. Lawnmower Man is a terrific example of a terrifying story made into an incomprehensible film. And the Tommyknockers, the TV version of the Tommyknockers, which by the way, Tommyknockers is subpar King to begin with. So when you take subpar King and then decide to change it to make it fit your idea of what that's going to be, you've got scrambled eggs. You've got a mess.
Well, okay, let's sort through the scrambled eggs for a second here, and I'm going to ask each one of you here at the table to tell me what embodies a Stephen King story. What elements in a Stephen King story at its base can you open the book and start reading without knowing who wrote it and go, oh, this is Stephen King? What is it about his writing that first of all made him so prolific and successful? And when you read a Stephen King book or short story, what elements do you take from that and really enjoy? What about Stephen King makes you happy? I'll start with Aaron, if you don't mind.
Well, for me, I mean, most of his best stories are not just about evil that comes from the outside and attacks something. It's also about the evil within. All of his best stories, but especially, again, I'm focusing on Salem's Lot. In Salem's Lot, the evil that surrounds the Marston house and that has been laying like a mist or a fog. The mist is another example, but like a mist or a fog over this town. It has that that quality of Shirley Jackson, you know, the this house was evil almost even before it was built. You know, this area, there was something wrong with this area. Something dwelt there. And I love the my favorite Stephen King story is Pet Sematary. Same thing. They go to a place that is older than any communities around it. This place has been there for a long time. There's evil there that does not sleep, you know, and it manifests when you bury something in that ground. Same thing with the Marston House. Even if they tore down the Marston House, that evil would still linger there. And so you jump back and forth with all these characters in the Stephen King story, and almost all of them have something askew about their lives. Something is wrong. They have a want. They have a yearning need that is not being met. They have a loss that they are struggling with, an emptiness that they're trying to fill. And I love that. It really just lays this shroud of sadness and gloom over everything, that when you're reading this book and stuff is happening, you're just like, oh, these poor people. But man, they were messed up even before the vampire came to town, or even before the mist showed up, or whatever it is. And I love that. I love that element of Stephen King, where it's the evil outside that is coming to affect you and to threaten your way of life or whatever, but there's also that inner hidden evil that's always been there and will always be there. And it's those two interacting, those forces, those dark forces interacting that I find fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us can follow what Aaron just said. So, I mean, his poetic heart and his mind are in perfect sync, and we can just
end
the podcast
right
different.
Here. Well,
We're still gonna tromp through the list here, folks. So Mickey, be thinking. Mark, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no. For me, the kind of what I touched on already is the everyman point of view that King brings to it. The setup is always the best part for me, where we get these wonderful little observations and turns of phrases that we just don't see in other books. Forget which one of the books mentions somebody falling asleep to the sound of his own bed farts, you know, and that's and that bed farts being a real specific thing, you know.
That actually sounds familiar. I think that's in Salem's Lot. That sounds very familiar.
Well, I actually think it was in Pet Sematary, But nevertheless, or it was in Thinner, but in any case.
Well, I read Pet Sematary too and loved it. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sure. No. He makes it very easy for you to come in, and relate to these characters. He's very good at setting that stage, whether it's through dialogue or through observation. You know, Jack Torrance's first observation in The Shining, during the interview at the Overlook Hotel. And he thinks to himself, what an officious little prick, you know. Yeah. And it's an italicized thought because that's how King does his thoughts. But without ever getting a description of the guy, you know who he is, you know. So there's a wonderful quality that he has about really giving you that not just normal, but almost workaday environment. And so it does make it scarier when the bad stuff starts happening. That's one of the hallmarks of his work, is that we care deeply about these characters, even as they're getting their faces ripped off or eaten. That's what makes The Stand so effective as a novel. He introduces a lot of characters and starts killing them almost immediately. And your first thought is, hey, I liked her. Hey, I liked him, you know?
Yeah.
So he's very good. And I think that's Don Robertson, and to some degree, some of the John D. MacDonald that he read growing up as well. There's an efficiency with which he can do this in a small space. You know, you want to know more about these characters, and when the bad things start happening, you root for them. Not a lot of people can generate genuine sympathy for their characters, especially horror characters. And so it's a deceptively hard thing to write. People think all you have to do is just drop some blood in there or have the vampire come in out of the darkness and Bob's your uncle. When in fact, there's a real craft that goes into writing effective horror, and not just effective horror, but the horror that will scare other people. That's a hard thing to do. And he is, or was, very good at it.
And by the way, that is the biggest complaint that people have about many movies nowadays, is that you cannot possibly, if you don't care about the characters, you don't care about the $150 million worth of CGI and special effects and explosions. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But if you care, the moment you invest in a character and you care about a relationship or whatever, you're in, you're golden. You are now on the right path. It's the difference between an empty superhero movie and Wonder Woman, you know?
Right.
And so, no, very, very well stated, Mark. I agree. I think King absolutely makes you invest and care about the various characters in his works.
Mickey, what about you, my friend? What makes Stephen King novels pop for you?
Well, I'm going to tie it in with something that Mark was saying about the voice. I have several friends from Maine, including one that, like, lived down the street from Stephen King. And the fact that he lives in Maine, he has apparently so many weird things to pull from as far as personality quirks.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I'm kind of at a loss here because the only Stephen King novel I was ever able to finish was The Stand. Ironically, it's the longest. That was the only one that drew me in. I tried to read The Gunslinger. I couldn't. I'm highly looking forward to the movie because I've been interested in it. I just couldn't get into the book. There's a lot of Stephen King that I tried to start, and I'm really more of a Dean Koontz person.
Wow. So you've seen a lot of the Stephen King movies and TV shows, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, and the things that I like are stuff like The Mist. I have a funny feeling I'm going to like It, the original adaptation of It. I only cared when Pennywise was on the screen. I didn't get into it, but I suspect that the new adaptation I'm going to like a lot.
I'm really looking forward to that new adaptation. It just looks really solid.
Yeah.
The only way it's going to work is if they decide to only shoot the first part of the novel, because
don't show them when they're adults.
Yeah, I think It is one of Stephen King's worst books, and
never read it.
I think that the solution that he comes up with to end the novel is one of the worst things he's ever written, and I have read some crap from him, and so it looks like the movie is only going to focus on the first part of the story.
Yeah,
which
I
think
is all be kids.
Part one.
Throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
There's two movies, folks.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
okay.
It's It Part One, The Losers Club, and It Part Two is going to be The Adults.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. Two movies.
I think they're going to have to rewrite it completely.
The kids part is going to be, I mean, we've already seen from Stranger Things and such that there is a hunger for that kind of a story for these kinds of characters. So if they do that, if It, the first part, is similar to Stranger Things in tone and feel and characters, then I think they have a pretty good shot of making it successful.
Speaking of which, Stranger Things may be my favorite King adaption.
Go ahead.
Say it again.
Stranger Things may be my favorite one of all the adaptations.
You mean is it?
Yes.
Are you speaking of Needful Things?
No.
By the way,
Stephen King himself thinks that Stranger Things is one of the best adaptations of his works.
Mark, I want to know, because I haven't read Dean Koontz, wouldn't catch it.
I haven't read the novel, Mark, and I don't care. We warn people about spoilers. What is it about the ending of It that absolutely ruins it for you?
All right, I'm going to just take one quick pause here so that people can make a note if they want to step away.
Spoiler coming. Warning. Spoiler for It coming.
He spends the first half of the novel giving you this clown in the sewers that is absolutely terrifying, and it is a creepy, creepy image, the likes of which you see in both the original TV series and – in this movie, and this is a clown that pulls children into the sewers and they're never seen again. And
I'm so sorry. It's not a clown. Its favorite form is a clown.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
But at the beginning of the book, you don't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You don't. Okay,
okay. That's what.
Yeah, that's
my
point. Is that you spend the first half of the book with this thing that's hunting children, and Derry Maine's known for its disappearances, and this is something that we just don't talk about because it's usually some of these weird kids. When you find out what the big reveal is in King's book, it's basically a giant telepathic spider.
Yep.
Now, the telepathic spider has taken the sort of collective fears of its victims and made a clown. But it's a telepathic spider. Mm-hmm. And the way that they have to defeat it in the book is all four of the guys have to have sex with the girl.
What?
You heard me.
No, you're making that up.
If I'm lying, I'm dying. It is.
What?
It is the craziest. I mean, it was like, here's the deal. In 1988, when the book came out, I'm carrying it around in hardcover, which is not a big deal. People knew I was a reader in high school. This wasn't a problem. People, you know, were asking me, is it good? And I was like, yeah, so far it's great. You know, the stuff that's great is the history of Derry Maine, because that's vintage Don Robertson that he's channeling. And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty cool. It's long, but I'm into it. That ending was such a clothesline moment. It just knocked me off of my bicycle that I gave my hardback away and gave it to a kid that wanted to read it, because I was so profoundly disappointed.
Okay. So does he explain why in the novel? Is it explained why?
Yes,
okay,
he
please,
does.
Please. I got to hear this. Please tell
because
me
it's
why.
It's not just sex for sex sake.
No.
Let's face it. It's all about bringing the group together. It's their collective energy that must defeat it. Okay. So, you know, and that's how do two people meld together? How do people become one? Well, that's obviously a way.
So it's kind of Guardians of the Galaxy ending, but rapey?
No, it's not rapey. It's not like she's being forced to do it. Yeah, she knows that's the way to do it. We're talking about they're facing a demonic entity that, and let's be clear, this is a very important part of the book to me, is yes, it appears as Pennywise, the dancing clown, but it also appears as the werewolf from I Was a Teenage Werewolf. It appears mm-hmm. as the mummy. It appears as the Gill Man. It actually kills someone disguised as the creature from the Black Lagoon. It does a phantom, spurts of blood, Georgie's ghost. It appears in so many different ways. It just happens to really favor.
Different things.
Right.
Okay.
So I can't wait to see this in the movie. I can't wait to see if they're going to show us these things through the eyes of adolescence, because I Was a Teenage Werewolf is not a scary movie, but in the eyes of an 8-year-old, it might be, and especially in that time frame.
I believe
that
they
Michael
are.
Landon
I think
werewolf.
In one of the previews, yeah. I saw different forms.
Oh, I cannot wait! I can't wait to see it.
Paint the picture for me. So they're in the sewers. They're hunting for this telepathic spider, as adults, right. And right before they're about, okay, we found him. There's a telepathic spider. Pete, quick, come here. Take your pants off. I mean, what's the context? Get on me.
This
you,
is like an
here.
Archer
come
episode
here.
Gone horribly
I got,
wrong.
I got two hands here. Come on. What? Please explain to me how, when they're in the sewers as adults hunting the spider, she suddenly turns to the other terrified, sweaty, dirty guys and says, let's go for it, fellas.
And the spider lets them.
I think the book is emblematic of King at his worst. We know that he's had problems with alcohol and cocaine, and certainly all the money that he got didn't help those things. He also reached a point in his career, I think it started with Pet Sematary, the book, where he was sort of the 800-pound gorilla in that if you were assigned to edit the new Stephen King book, you just took the pages and said, thank you, sir, may I have another? Because why would you challenge someone who sold this many copies of the book? And I think that those things probably combined to do him a disservice. There's several middling Stephen King novels where you can tell this would have been better if it was structured a little differently, or this didn't need to be this long or whatever. I think it is the poster child for that. It is.
No, but I mean,
to answer your question, Aaron, no.
Okay, so should they have sex first, and then charged with their sexual energy, they go down into the sewers and confront the spider.
There's a final battle in the lair. And they're not having sex in the sewer, if I remember correctly. You know, this is something that but it's their collective energy that they build, the trust and the sacrifice that they've made to get to this point. And they're all so close to each other, and it's like, let's bond, let's make this unbeatable bond kind of thing. Again, it sounds so clinical the way Mark says it, but it's not like, okay, you're next, check, and now you're next, check.
Well, that's what I'm trying to picture.
No, it's not that.
What does happen?
Mark simplified it because he's looking at it through the lens of someone who doesn't like it. Okay. So he's saying it the way, oh, yeah, all they had to do was have sex. It's like me saying, like the ending of Lost, all you had to do was take a giant stone dildo and stick it in the hole in the island, and you're done. That's not what happened.
All you gotta do is throw the ring into the mountain. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So all I'm asking is, so then what does happen? Or do they get together at the Motel 6 before? Like, what happens?
Yeah, they basically discuss how they're gonna defeat it and what it is, and they've kind of figured out that whatever it is, it's down there. It didn't stop when they went away. They basically come back and find that their childhood monsters, their collective fear, is still there, and it's one thing, not five things.
Ritual. There's a ritual of chud that they have to do. There's an actual ritual that banishes it, that puts it to sleep, because it goes. It's like the creature from what's that movie?
Jeepers Creepers. Yeah.
Yeah. It comes in waves. And it prefers children, which you go. Oh well, we got to stop this thing. So there's a ritual.
The ritual's performed at whatever, somebody's house, a hotel, some other place.
Well, they do it in front of it. They have to do it with it.
Oh,
there.
So they do have sex in front of it.
No. The sex isn't part of the ritual.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's a different thing. And the other thing, the interesting part about it is that it's revealed that it's female.
Oh.
The creature is female and has laid eggs.
Okay.
Okay, so stay with me.
I'm with you.
Okay. So they destroy not only it, but they have to destroy the eggs as well.
So it's like an Easter hunt.
Essentially, yes. But
it's like Angry Birds. It's like Angry Birds. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, the characters literally, I mean, again, Mark, help me out here. They tear it to pieces and literally crush its heart. They have to crush the heart in its hands.
Right.
Killing it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all of that.
I'm sorry that I'm obsessed with this. And then they have sex?
Sex comes before.
That's what I'm saying. So before they get together, they say, hey, you know what? We're preparing ourselves. Let's all have sex.
Yeah, it's the thing that's going to basically armor them. Their love for each other.
Charlie, you first. Hold on. I'm not done with you, Bob. Hold on. You know, so they go to wherever, a hotel, house, whatever.
It's not a graphic scene, but the point at which they realize they've got to do this is the point that an 18-year-old guy made entirely of testosterone hopped off the bus. So if I who am most inclined to think, yeah, sex could stop a monster. There's never been a time in my life when I didn't think that could happen. If I get to that point in the book and go, that's your plan. To me, it knocked me out of the narrative. And
I see. Okay.
I
was just picturing a very different, like, there they are. You know, it's the typical scene. They're holding, you know, torches, and they're covered in sewer slime. And she suddenly turns to one of them and says, "Get on me right now!"
It's not so Flesh Gordon in that capacity.
Okay.
However, at this point, I'm considering naming this episode number 43. And then they had sex.
Yeah. So then Sam doesn't turn to Frodo and says, "Mr. Frodo, with a good shagging, we can beat Sauron."
That's what the ring's for.
All right, Sam. Oh God.
Although the man love is pretty profound there.
We have seen in the movie that the ring can grow to suit whatever thing it's put on. So anyway.
Okay, put it back in your pants.
I had no clue, guys. I had no clue that is.
That's not the crux, though. You can't go. They beat it through having sex. That's not how they beat it.
No, that's not how they beat it. But I wanted. I'll tell you what disappointed me was that it was basically a telepathic spider, and I expected more from him, especially since this thing took different forms. I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be a jelly, or I wanted it to be a something a little more Cthulhoid in nature. I wanted it to be something.
The spider is kind of Cthulhoid.
It's sort of.
It's not a spider. It's got multiple legs. I mean,
I'll just tell you. The thing is, when you talk about multiple legs sitting in the middle of a lair, surrounded by eggs, I'm gonna go to spider. Yeah. You know, that's the problem.
No, I see what you mean. Yeah, something more Lovecraftian, more, you know, an amorphous shape, you know, that kind of thing. Okay.
What this felt like, Prince of Darkness, Cream of Wheat, both then and now.
Yeah.
No, not even that. What this felt like then and now. You know, back then when I was reading it and looking back on it, what it felt like was, shit, I guess I got to wrap this up. Okay, so we'll just do this, you know, and he tickety-tacks it out. And literally, the ending is the last 20 pages. I mean, it's just literally the whole thing. It really feels like it falls apart at the end because he was bored. He was tired. He was distracted. I hate the book. Because I invested so much in the first part of it and was so profoundly let down when I got to the end. I didn't feel that way with The Shining. I didn't feel that way with Salem's Lot. I didn't feel that way with The Stand. There are other books where he sticks the dismount. The Bachman books, even thinner, for crying out loud. So many others where he got it right. Carrie is a great example of something that builds to a crescendo. I felt like, and especially because this was ended up being a monster movie book, I wanted something more epic. I wanted something more fitting the 900 pages I had read to get to it.
I gotcha. Okay.
I mean, there's enough references in the creature. The it creature at the end that make it a little bit less more of a spider and more of a Drider Cthulhu-esque type of thing. It does have arms, you know, and it has a neck and a head, and it's got multiple legs, and it's got a chest. It's not just a spider. I mean, let's be fair.
Isn't there like a magical turtle and at some point too? The kids see a magical turtle. And the turtle is the one that teaches them the ritual, or am I making this up?
I don't remember.
That's the anime version. I don't remember that.
I don't remember the turtle. It's
Pokemon.
Maybe. I remember the only thing I remember from the TV series, because I didn't watch the whole thing, was at some point one of them gets a flashback because they see turtle wax. They see the turtle wax product, and then they have a dream of this shell that is sailing over them. This in this weird cosmic kind of looking area, and I could have sworn there was something about a magic turtle.
Gamera is really neat.
That's what made me think of it. It's like, wait a minute, isn't there? I could have sworn there's a magic turtle.
Were you reading Discworld at the same time you were reading this book?
Discworld, but okay.
The thing is that the TV series obviously fixed some stuff. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that they're going to do the same thing with this movie. I'd be really, really surprised if the ending of the second movie bears any resemblance to what we've got. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I'm certainly in for the first one. The first one looks terrifying, and looks like they may have gotten a lot of the visuals right. You know, they've updated it in the book. It's in the 50s. Mm-hmm. They've updated it to the 70s. So that we can, you know, or the 80s, so that we can feel like it's still happening. So I'm in, you know, sign me up. But I'm in with the proviso that I'm not investing anything in this. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe that's the best way to go in, you know, because I feel like, you know, if you can scare me with me knowing what it is, then you've done something great, you know?
Yeah, and I'm willing to give it a shot as well. I didn't. One thing that I wanted to share with the table is when I read a Stephen King book, or when I think of a Stephen King book, the part that I enjoy the most, and this, I guess, this boils down to the details, the devil being in the details with the ritual of Chud and the battle of wills and the let's join together in physical and mental harmony, is the detail that Stephen King puts in. And it's not necessarily, it's platform, yes, but I love the fact that he can call to mind things like the flavor of bubblegum or the smell of popcorn or the physical details that make me think, oh, I know that. Yeah. I've been there. I know what Pop Rocks taste like. I've drank that cherry Coke before. I've had that, you know? Nostalgia. And that's where he gets you. It's where he gets me. He takes you completely off guard because you relax into it and go, oh, yes, that's familiar. Oh, my God, that's great. Hey, that's weird. What's that? Don't touch that. No, don't go. The sewer is bad. What are you doing? No, don't stick your arm in there. Crap.
It, yeah.
We're done. You know, and that's to me what I love about Stephen King. And he does it in almost all his novels. There's an establishment with the platform, but he does it so well to link to shared memories, to that recall, that sensory recall that we all can do. You go, oh, yeah. I know. And, you know, even if it's not exact, it's something similar. I remember that. I remember how that felt, the feelings, and even the emotional sensory recall, first loves, kisses, crushes, you know, the mysteries inside skirts and blouses that boys have. Those are memories, shared memories.
Boys
that
have
he
mysteries
pulls
inside
from.
Their blouses?
No, we have mysteries about what happens in other in shirts and blouses of women. You know, it's that whole what's it like kind of thing where he does that so well. He did it in Stand By Me, really, or The Body, excuse me, in the story of The Body. And of course, in It. And anytime there's children playing a part, adolescent children, he does it really, really well.
Well, my favorite Stephen King story is The Jaunt from Skeleton Crew.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a science fiction story that involves teleportation, and it's got a kid in it too, and
I'm a big fan of The Night Flyer. I love that short story.
Oh my God, that's such a great story.
And there's a visual of The Night Flyer, and they made it into a movie, which, you know, wasn't that great. Wasn't that bad, but it wasn't that great. The short story, though, was really, really good. In brief, it's about this vampire. It's another Stephen King vampire film who travels from airport to airport, beating the sunrise every single time and feasting at the airport and moving on to the next airport. He's in a single engine plane.
I remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
And the visual stunning image to me was our narrator, our hero in the movie, finds the entire airport slaughtered, covered in blood, dead, stumbles into the bathroom to vomit, and looks up in the mirror, and behind him in the mirror he sees the urinal, and there's an invisible something there because he can't see it in the mirror, but then there's a stream of blood. Urine, a blood piss coming out of nothing, hitting the urinal, and he's going to the bathroom behind him.
Yeah, I remember that too.
And he's terrified and he doesn't turn around. He never sees the vampire. The vampire talks to him. He's right behind him. He just did his little shake and he's done and he leaves. And I just thought that was so well done because I didn't want to see the vampire. I wanted to have this because the character spends the entire short story following him from airport to airport. Trying to catch him, trying to figure out what's going on with this character, and the vampire had a great sense of humor because he called himself Renfield. His character name was something Renfield. I thought that was really, really nice twist. But I love that story. Yeah,
that image is one of my favorite images out of his stuff. It's such a good, great story. Yeah, it was first published in a book called Primeval.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
And by the way, so The Mist, we just started watching the TV series The Mist, and we're two episodes in. And again, I've not read the original short story, and people say that I absolutely should. And I think I want to now because I'm intrigued enough by things that are going on that we don't really explain in the movie. I like the movie too, by the way. Very bleak ending, but...
And there's a 3D audio book as well.
Okay. Well, I'm intrigued.
Specifically to creep you out with the 3D-ness.
Yeah, I'm definitely intrigued by that concept of what is the mist? Why are these things appearing in the mist? What's the connection with the secret military facility up in the hills or whatever? But there's a lot of, I love that there's this new, I guess resurgence, but Stephen King never really faded from the scene as far as adaptations of his or novels of his. He's been pretty prolific and pretty steady. But yeah, there's so many. We talked about some of the adaptations here on the show today. That Shawshank Redemption is fantastic. I love The Shining. I love Stand By Me. Which one? Shawshank Redemption?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
What do you think, Mickey?
I really liked it. I haven't seen The Green Mile, and I think that a lot of my resistance to seeing the Shawshank Redemption in the first place was a misunderstanding, thinking it was really depressing, which apparently Green Mile is.
Yes and no.
Yeah, okay. Green Mile is more. It's certainly more of a downer than Shawshank Redemption.
Okay.
I had no idea
that the Shawshank Redemption was what it was. So, yeah. So when I saw it, I'm like, why didn't somebody force me to watch this earlier?
Stephen King had another TV series that came out recently that was Stephen King inspired, that was Under the Dome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That had a nice run.
Did anybody? I didn't watch that.
I watched the first season.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, and then by the end of it, I was like, "Oh, they're really dragging this out," but they have to. It's a TV series.
There was also an adaptation of The Golden Years, which I've tried to rewatch recently, and it's not good. But Keith Zabrzaraka, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. You'd recognize him if you saw him. You'd definitely recognize his voice. I believe was nominated for an Emmy, if he didn't win it, for playing the janitor aging backwards.
Okay.
Because he was like, you know, 30 at the time that he was cast in that.
Right.
Okay. They did it with the old age makeup and was reversing things, and he did a fantastic job.
I did watch the first season of Under the Dome. What I found, what I liked best about it was the sort of characters from Stephen King's central casting department.
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The greatest hits. The greatest hits. You had the creepy son and the corrupt town leader and
There's sort of a by the numbers Stephen King approach to the whole thing, and I suspect that it was written with the idea of, well, they're going to give me money for this anyways, I might as well make it look like a TV series, you know?
Yeah.
It was fun to watch that. And I think what happened over time is there was enough stuff that came out, mostly done by, Darabont and, Rob Reiner and, whoever did, Misery, names escaping me, but there was enough stuff that got made where they took Stephen King's weird ass concepts and made that into a TV show or a movie, that people realized, oh, we don't have to change things to make it, you know, Stephen King. It's going to be Stephen King if we just do this, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought it worked really well. It certainly wasn't scary to me, but it struck me as exactly the kind of science fiction concept that Stephen King comes up with, which is where he takes almost a kind of a 1930s pulp approach, you know, instead of people living in domed cities, let's just clamp a dome down on this city and watch people, you know, revert, which is, you know, effectively the thing that would be more interesting to him anyways. Yeah. So
by the way, Misery Mark was also Rob Reiner.
Yes. Oh, that was Reiner. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
You
know,
and you mentioned Misery, you mentioned The Shining these are films that are books, excuse me, stories, concept ideas. And this is what I like about Stephen King. He takes things that inspire him from his real life. You know, he had moments of isolation while writing The Shining, and because the character's a writer. You know, he got injured in that horrible car accident that put him, you know, out of commission for a while and was laid up. He couldn't do anything. So we got Christine and we got Misery, both back to back. You know, you have anytime you have those kinds of, you know, real life events that happen to you and you can be inspired by that. Yeah, Christine. Yeah.
Well, that's what I love about. I mean,
Christine before he got hit.
I think Christine was before.
And then Misery was written while he was laid up there.
I love that he bases so many things on stuff. We just saw a documentary on Pet Sematary, and I had no idea that he had moved in next door to a woman in Maine that had a pet cemetery spelled exactly like it's spelled in the book. She had left the sign up to her son. She said, here, put Pet Cemetery on it. And her son, of course, didn't bother to check the spelling. And it was a thing. It was a thing. And they lived right by, what is it, Interstate 15 or whatever. And he had a moment with his son, who now Joe Hill, who was running towards the road the way Gage was running towards the road. And so all of these, you know, his daughter's cat had died. And so they didn't want to tell the daughter, you know, what are we going to do? But they were going to go bury it in the pet cemetery. And so all of these things, I think they ring true because they are true. These are all things that Stephen King experienced directly. And the woman
slightly
is interviewed.
Left of center because, as my friends from Maine would say, he's in Maine.
I do need to offer a correction. King was hit by that driver in 1999.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Many years after he wrote Pet Cemetery
and
Misery and all of those things. And so it was the, you know, what the joke at the time was, well, clearly he manifested it because he'd been writing about it for so long, which is kind of which is a really shitty thing to say, you know.
Right. But also very Stephen King.
Right.
But my
point with Pet Sematary was just that all that is based on stuff that he actually experienced. He lived next door to the woman, who they interview in the documentary, and they talk about a lot of the inspirations for that story. But that's another one of my favorite of his novels. It scared the crap out of me.
The book was good. I hate that movie is Fred Gwynn's last role. I hate that that's the movie that Tasha Yar decided to leave Next Generation to pursue her acting career. And I think probably the best thing about the film is the Ramones soundtrack hit. I don't want to be buried in a pet
cemetery.
So I'm getting you didn't like the movie.
I thought it was ass.
Which one's worse, the ending of it or that movie?
I'm actually surprised because I Pet Cemetery, one of those films that I thought was done very well because I never ever wanted to see it again. I saw it once and it was such a heart-rending moment for me. And I wasn't a father then. But the way that sequence is filmed, when Gage does get hit by the truck and we do that multiple, he's screaming in the road, the little shoe is there, and flash images of him as a baby getting bathed, getting changed, being held, boom, boom, boom. Yeah. And then we're in the funeral and they get into a big fight and the coffin falls and his little hand is in there. Oh, my God. Yeah. I just thought that's horror. That is horror. And everything else, all the other bullshit, whatever, I've seen it before. But that moment, because you knew it was coming. Good God, you knew it was coming. The
and
dread.
By the way, directed by a woman. This is important to point out. In 89, in a genre dominated by male directors, horror, it was directed by a woman, Mary Lambert. So
I thought it was very well put together. I enjoyed that movie.
I agree. I actually enjoyed. Now, if they remade it today, the part that didn't work for us as horror fans was just, you know, they were trying to get the best performance that they could out of this little boy actor who did a phenomenal job.
Right.
But, you know, when he's trying to be menacing, it's a little boy in makeup that you can kind of see the director. She's probably saying, all right, sweetie, you know, be mean, you know, growl at me or whatever.
Yeah, right, right.
Today it would be CGI and it would be completely terrifying and absolutely convincing.
Well, we, you know, let's be fair. This the book itself owes a lot to Murnau's The Monkey's Paw.
That is said in the documentary. It is Stephen King's version of The Monkey's Paw.
The Monkey Paw.
Right. And I think what doesn't work for me, it was better in the book because I think with a book, you've got more space and we're willing to give an author more space to establish that baseline normalcy. So you end up liking everybody in the story. And then when everything goes horribly, horribly wrong, we're sympathetic. I don't think the movie does a good job of getting you there. I think it tries to be creepy early on and isn't creepy enough. It tries to be normal early on and isn't normal enough. Mm-hmm. And
the little kid, the daughter and the little kid and the cat, the little girl, when she lost her cat, was sad. And then he said, I'm going to help my daughter by bringing this cat back to life. And then Church was walking around smelling like rot and death and scratching people. And the daughter's like, I don't want to sleep with him anymore.
I'm waiting for the inevitable Church versus Cujo, you know, sort of like Freddy versus Jason.
Yes.
I felt that in terms of beats, okay, in terms of like making this work, it felt to me like something that they kind of did similar to Children of the Corn.
I was just about to say Children of the Corn. That would be that would be one of the bad movies for me. I just didn't like that movie.
Yeah.
They had this concept and I think they fleshed it out the wrong way. Mm-hmm. To me, the scariest part of the show of Pet Sematary is when they finally figures out how to send him back and Gage says, "No fair."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's this very childlike, "No fair," you know. But there's an intention behind it that feels very sinister, which I really, to me, that's the only, and it bothers me that that's the part of the story where I was finally engaged. So that's all it is. I just wanted to,
To be fair, I may have been colored. I read the book first before seeing the movie and I loved the book and the book creeped the shit out of me. So when I'm watching the movie, I'm bringing a lot more to it.
Yeah.
Than might actually be there on screen. I will admit that. But I know. I mean, I'm experiencing the pain of the father, not just by what I'm seeing on screen, but because of what I know. I've read the novel, so it might have made a difference. It might have made a difference. But I would not be surprised if Pet Sematary is one of those that we see get a remake. Mark my words, gentlemen. Yes. We will see Pet Sematary get a remake within the next few years.
I'm up in Castle Rock.
It needs a remake. I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
By the way, just to prove that I'm not crazy, I looked it up. Mm. The creature's name is Maturin. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it. Maturin. Maturin is the turtle and one of the 12 guardians of the beams that hold up the Dark Tower. Described as being a turtle of massive size with an ancient appearance, Maturin existed long before the creation of the mainstream universe in Stephen King's novels. By nature, Maturin is kind and benevolent, having a very grandfather-like demeanor when speaking to humans. Maturin is said to be constantly withdrawn into a shell, sleeping and rarely ever coming out for anything. In fact, it messes with the minds of the losers by telling them that Maturin is dead. There is a giant turtle. I did not imagine.
And it's crossover because it's written for the Dark Tower, right?
Yep.
The creature. So that's kind of neat that he's jumping. He's taking universes that he's created and kind of melding them together. That the It universe exists in the same universe as the Dark Tower, somehow.
I will. I'll be the first to say that while I haven't read Stephen King novels in a while, I still go back to the short stories and I think he's still a talented writer, certainly one of the most influential writers of the 20th century and deservedly so.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And even if the movies don't always and the TV shows don't always live up to their promise, I think he deserves all of his success for what he's been able to do, legitimizing horror, bringing horror into the mainstream, making it more acceptable. And I suspect we're going to be talking about him again. We're about to get a miniseries on Hulu called Castle Rock, which is going to be short stories based in essentially, I'm assuming, the Castle Rock universe. Yep. How cool is that going to be?
Very.
I'm excited about that. I love short form Stephen King, I think, is the best, and a format that celebrates his short stories, like Jerusalem's Lot, for example, would be is probably what they're going to start with. You know, his combination of Rats in the Walls meets, you know, 1950s vampire is, I know, how exciting.
Well, I just saw a graveyard shift, so I went, oh god, no.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot to draw from.
Yeah,
I'm very much looking forward to a series like that. I mean, it's almost like when they announced, I forget whether it's Key or Peele. I always get them confused. But the guy that directed Get Out has been basically given a TV show. Well, they pitched a TV show.
Jordan Peele.
That's right. And it is going to be based basically on Lovecraft stuff. It's going to be adapting a bunch of old Lovecraft stories, but then making them relevant to, obviously, to things that would be of interest to Peele, to racism in today's society, classism in today's society. I think it might even be called like Lovecraft Country or Cthulhu Country or something like that. But I love that they're doing this, folks. I love that they are taking Stephen King's world and giving it a TV series, taking Lovecraft's world and giving it a TV series.
Well, I mean, I think we can all agree that while Stephen King isn't necessarily everyone's cup of tea, and certainly adaptations go from bad to worse, from hits to misses, his output is prolific and important, and he has created some of the most unique themes in horror. Everything from possessed cars to possessed mangling machines and laundromats to giant rats to vampires to werewolves and just his imagination to put these things together to present them. Now, mind you, you could trace them back to inspiration and say, well, obviously he gets that. Again, read Dance Macabre. He explains where this comes from. It's all right there. But he brought it into the mainstream, and many people who didn't have the exposure to old EC comics of the 1950s, who didn't have that inspiration of watching late night horror hosts and seeing all these B horror movies, are watching them again, whether they realize it or not, through the works of Stephen King.
We said at the beginning of the show, it you would be hard pressed to name another author who has had as much influence on popular culture, on media. As Stephen King, he is the Charles Dickens of our era. He is the Alexander Dumas of our era. I can't think of anyone. I cannot think of a single author who I would say, this guy has had more influence on media and geek culture than Stephen King. Not one springs to mind.
You're absolutely correct, sir. And I'm afraid on that note, looking at Maximilian, and he's getting into a magenta look here, we're going to have to end our Stephen King discussion. We do have some great Stephen King films coming up. We've got The Dark Tower finally being adapted.
Yes.
So that's going to be very exciting, as well as the remake of It. The Losers Club will be the very first one out of the gate that we'll be able to enjoy. And then we'll see what else happens in our world.
The Mist TV show currently going on.
Oh, that's right.
And, of course, Castle Rock about to be launched for Netflix.
So Stephen King Hulu, is still...
Think, right? Oh, sorry, Hulu. Is it Hulu? Yeah.
It's the only service I don't have, which is why I'm going to
Okay.
Well, Stephen King's still very influential, still very positive influence in fantasy and horror, and I personally want to see him continue to create, and I want to see more adaptations of newer stuff. I would be excited to see a Stephen King developed TV show that's not based on one of his original stories that he maybe works with to create right off the top of his head. I'd like to see something like that. But regardless, I'm going to tune in. Of course I'm going to tune in. It's Stephen King, and it's always entertaining. Speaking of entertaining, gentlemen nerds, glasses up, final toast.
Yes.
To you. All right. Mark Finn, final words on Stephen King.
Just because I don't like it doesn't mean you won't like it. But I'll reiterate, if you can find Don Robertson, check him out. And especially... the novel that Stephen King published through his own imprint, The Ideal Genuine Man. That's the Don Robertson novel you want to read if you want an insight on how much this guy meant to Stephen King.
Nice.
Wonderful. Mickey Finn.
I don't want to have any final thoughts when discussing Stephen King. He's getting kind of up there.
That's fair enough. Aaron De Oribe.
I recommend everybody go out and purchase and either read or listen to Salem's Lot, which, in my opinion, probably continues to be Stephen King's absolute best novel.
Gentlemen Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and is written by Aaron De Oribe, Mark Finn, Mickey Finn, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material provided by Ben Mears, Paul Sheldon, and Thad Beaumont. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds nameless mascot created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender, straight from the Overlook, was Lloyd. Thank you, Lloyd.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Our sound editor and accidental producer is Mickey Finn. Our executive producer and man that we all pray never, ever get superpowers is Aaron De Oribe. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher De Oribe. And Jack Torrance is the caretaker. He's always been the caretaker. Join us in the Lobot Lounge when next we meet. And please remember to always tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. This is Joseph Fotinos reminding you all once again that Red Skull lives.
I thought Church lived.
I like you, Lloyd. Always liked you. Best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine.
Oh my God.
Oregon, for that matter.
By the way, you guys didn't tell me this. I was reading this, but they all decide to have sex when they're kids. When they're the kids, they decide to have sex. I didn't know that. I thought they were adults having sex. I would venture to guess that is not going to be in the movie.
Well, yeah. Aaron, I would ask you this. I would ask you this because you seem a little fascinated by the idea of the ritual and what they have to do to defeat.
No, I love the aspect of the ritual. I just didn't realize there was sex involved.
But what I was going to suggest is, if you can find the time to read the book.
Oh God, yeah. I don't have.
Just read the ending.
But didn't they HBO. Do that? I mean, it was in the TV show. They did have a. And I think they did it individually. They didn't do all get together in a big orgy. They actually had an individual thing, right? Where they all kind of – it's been a while.
I never saw the original, so I don't know. Did they have sex in the original, Mark?
In the TV show, in series?
No, they didn't. Not in the,
they didn't?
No.
They cut that all together. I remember them joining hands and being on, like, you know, a kumbaya
now that
moment.
I could see. Right. I could see them hugging and like, oh, it's our love for each other and all that kind of stuff.